Hello, and welcome to One-on-One with LAPA, the Legislative Analysis and Public Policy Association's podcast series, where experts discuss key issues and emerging topics in the areas of public health and safety, substance use disorder, and the criminal justice system. LAPA is funded by a grant from the Office of National Drug Control Policy, Executive Office of the President. Neither the Office of National Drug Control Policy nor any other federal instrumentality operate, control, or are responsible for or necessarily endorse this podcast. I'm Shan Kemper, Senior Legislative Attorney with LAPA, and your host for today's podcast on the topic of state efforts to improve the continuum of care for substance and opioid use disorder. Improving substance use and opioid use disorder outcomes and reducing health disparities across all or some of populations affected by SUD or OUD in America must start on the local and state level. But why, and perhaps more importantly, how? To help us answer these questions, I am delighted to introduce my guests today, Dr. Brittany Allen and Dr. Catherine Marks. I first heard Dr. Allen and Dr. Marks speak at the RX Summit in April of 2022, during their presentation on the topic for today's show. I was blown away by their enthusiasm and expertise on state efforts to develop and implement evidence-based interventions that link individuals with SUD to care and treatment while also building a sustainable infrastructure that reduces barriers to access for high-quality treatment and recovery support. Dr. Brittany Allen is the Interim Director of the Substance Use Disorder Division for the Kentucky Department for Behavioral Health, Developmental and Intellectual Disabilities. Dr. Catherine Mark is the project director for the Kentucky Opioid Response Effort at the Kentucky Department for Behavioral Health, Developmental and Intellectual Disabilities. I'm honored to speak with both of you today. Dr. Allen, can you tell our audience a little bit about yourself and your work? Dr. Mark, if you could follow up and give our listeners your background and your work, and that would be wonderful.
Absolutely. And thank you, Chan, for inviting us here today. I am the director of our Division of Substance Use Disorder within our Department of Behavioral Health, Developmental and Intellectual Disabilities. And in that role, I oversee the provision of federal and state funding, including our SAMHSA Mental Health and Substance Use Prevention Block Grant dollars. And those are used to support and expand the implementation of a vast array of substance use services across our Commonwealth of Kentucky. I also received my doctorate degree in behavioral science at the University of Rhode Island, and my research interests revolved around the impacts of discrimination on behavioral health outcomes, which certainly informed my want to engage and expand equity efforts across our system of care.
Yeah, thank you so much, Tian, again, for the opportunity to have this conversation and to have it with Dr. Allen as well. I so enjoy this dialogue together. I serve as the project director and a co-principal investigator for CORE, which is the Kentucky Opioid Response Effort, and that's housed in the Kentucky Department for Behavioral Health. So CORE is funded by a series of SAMHSA grants, which is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, and its mission is to increase equitable access to high-quality and evidence-based prevention, harm reduction, treatment, and recovery support services. So to do this, we fund over 150 distinct initiatives across the service continuum. And last year, we served the CORE funded providers, reached about 23,000 individuals, and over 50,000 free naloxone units, or Narcan, you might know them, were distributed. I think we'll talk about today the infrastructure that CORE has helped to embed with state agencies and community partners, and so I'll save some other of that for later, but I'm also an assistant professor with the University of Kentucky College of Medicine, and like Dr. Allen, I have a doctorate in behavioral science, and my training was focused on human laboratory and community-based research on behavioral and pharmacological interventions to support both stimulant and opioid use disorder remission.
Wow, we're not even 3 minutes in, and I'm already incredibly impressed by both of you. I'm serious. Before we go on to my next question, I did want to ask for a little bit more background. And what I mean by that is, what drew you to this work? And you can go in any order, but what sort of drew you to the work that you're doing currently?
Yeah, I'll start. You know, it began as passion for the broader behavioral health field. And the recognition that there were so many emerging evidence-based practices or long-standing evidence-based practices that had not reached the community, had not reached people. And so I wanted to be a part of that process. And so I personally actually started in preclinical animal research and said, wait, nope, that's not quite it. I moved in the human laboratory, said I need to get closer to people. I moved into the community, and now I'm here at a state and policy level. And so that general commitment was really important to me, but I also began to be able to put words to my own experience of addiction affecting my family and the experience and gifts of remission and recovery also coming to my family. And so I bring together those two perspectives and now talk about them in parallel and why I feel so passionate about these issues.
Wow, thank you. Dr. Allen?
Yeah, I similar to Dr. Marks, I think my passion really began from my own personal experience with a family member that had an addiction for several years and passed of an overdose in 2015. And the experience of, you know, her not knowing and our family not knowing what services were available, what services she could access, how to even address the addiction, overcoming the stigma of that addiction as well. And these are just all pieces for me that made me realize there's a gap here, especially within communities of color. And so how do we address that? How do we make sure the outreach is equitable, make sure that engagement is equitable, and make sure that service access is equitable? And so this is really a driver behind my want to engage in this work and engage in one of the key projects that we're going to be talking about with you today.
I feel like loss, pain, and trauma are, unfortunately, inform a lot of the great people that I've worked with and interacted with in this community. I feel like we're fortunate to have you both doing the work that you do, but it's sad that it's often based on the fact that we see the people that we love suffering. I mentioned earlier that I first saw both of you speak at the 2022 RX Summit at your presentation on state efforts to improve the continuum of care for substance and opioid use disorders. Can you elaborate on this topic and why you think it's important?
Absolutely. And I'd like to start with why it's important. And plain and simple, people are dying. You know, we're seeing that in our own personal lives. We're seeing that across the nation. The country is seeing some of the most dramatic increases in overdose deaths that we've ever seen. Over 2,200 Kentuckians died of an overdose in 2021. That was nearly a 15% increase over the previous year. And then between 2019 and 2020, we saw a 50% increase in overall overdose deaths. And that was one of the highest increases in the country. So this work is critical, quite literally life or death. And states have a responsibility to their citizens to ensure that quality services are available and accessible to every single person that's in need of those services. And of course, we've been working toward that for many years. Our substance use system of care has markedly improved and expanded across the continuum, in large part due to the collaborative impact of our Kentucky opioid response effort and other state and community partners aligned in common purpose and strategy to address the opioid and addiction crises. But when we look at national and state data and consider what we're learning from our community partners, we recognize that our system of care was in fact not serving every Kentuckian. And so just to provide you with some quick context, it's well known that, you know, of course, the opioid epidemic focused on white suburban and rural communities. And up until now, there really hasn't been much focus on this crisis and how it's impacted Black and Hispanic and Latinx and other communities of color. And that's despite the fact that these communities are experiencing similar dramatic increases in rates of substance use and also overdose deaths. So just to give you a little bit more data, in 2020, we saw a devastating 49% increase in overdose deaths among white Kentuckians. But we saw a 64% increase in overdose deaths among Black Kentuckians. And similarly, in 2021, there was a 12% increase in overdose deaths among white Kentuckians, but a 34% increase among Black Kentuckians. And we're also beginning to see increases trend within Hispanic and Latinx communities as well. And Unfortunately, this is not unique to Kentucky. This is a nationwide disparity. So again, as state agency leaders, we're responsible for creating and implementing opportunities to address these disparities and also to build a more equitable system. So when Dr. Marks and I came upon the State Learning Collaborative opportunity with the National Governors Association, it really served as the perfect starting place to build out this work.
Wow, that's profound. That's deeply profound in terms of the fact that inequity has shaped the numbers. I had not heard about the difference. I knew on a national scale, but in terms of Kentucky, such a stark difference in the death rate. Dr. Marks, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, and I think that's what's so powerful about having local data to see it come to home, because we know we're talking about our friends and we know we're talking about our families, but we don't really understand who those people are until we bring the data back home. And that's one of the key initiatives that we targeted with our NGA project. And I'll say that when we started this in early 2020, we knew some of this, but we didn't know the extent of it. The data hadn't come out in this way. And so when the National Governors Association released a request for applications, it was really broad. They said, we're looking to help states and develop and implement evidence-based practices, facilitate care coordination, build a sustainable treatment infrastructure that reduces barriers. And we'd had a successful history of working with them. And so we knew that they would be creative and flexible in our goals. And so what we came back to them and said is, we want our entire NGA project focused on equity. We want to improve access to the system of care, especially at this moment for Black Kentuckians. And so it was really exciting to unite around that purpose in that way. And it was really important that the National Governors Association responded so positively and so much help in that space. And so what we did is proposed a multi-level approach that addressed both the urgency that we knew that we had an overdose, but also kind of the more systemic issues as well. And so we'll unpack these, but the key project aims were around data disaggregation and review of that data, policy analysis, expansion of our provider capacity and resource allocation to BIPOC-led and BIPOC-serving providers in the community, and then improving, of course, outcomes for minoritized Kentuckians. But, and this work is still in progress, but I'll just really emphasize how important the support of the National Governors Association was in bringing really that technical assistance that we needed to be able to do this work, and then how grateful we were to tie this back to the ARC Summit, which is where we arrived earlier this year, for the opportunity to share this with other people and to continue to have platforms like this to talk about why it's so important.
Can you unpack a little bit, both of you, of how the project came together? I know you said the NGA put out a call, but can you talk a little bit about how you decided on those particular prongs and how the project, what were some of the bumps in the road? It was just really fascinating when you were talking about it at the RX Summit, because I had never thought about the sort of approach that the both of you took. And I would love for our listeners to hear a little bit more about that.
So Dr. Marks and I worked really closely to develop our application and, you know, put those goals pen to paper. One, of course, was looking at the data and understanding the data. And that became such a huge component of driving the program, because we needed to understand not only what those disparate outcomes were, but what was the disparate, what was disparate service access? What did that look like? And what was disparate in terms of the workforce and staffing? So there were just a lot of different components that on the data side that became a primary focus for us. And we thankfully had NGA and their technical assistance on our side to help us work through that, because interpreting data can obviously be really complex and complicated, and you can look at it one way and somebody could look at it a completely different way and interpret it differently. So it was really important that we looked at it and ensure that we had the best message and understood what it was telling us and allow that to inform and push the work forward. So I'll say that was definitely probably the key focal point why we were involved with NGA for the year of that project. And then just you know, from there, moving it forward and having our leadership support us in the different initiatives that we wanted to build out from there. So using our funding, leveraging our contracts, I mean, all these different pieces that we can discuss more, but deciding on what those strategies would be based on what we found and what gaps we wanted to be sure we filled in.
Yeah, and I'll say this is a great example of who you bring to the table is where priorities get placed, right? And so what we saw was just that. We brought to the table within state government, the Office of Drug Control Policy, representation from Medicaid, representation from our Office of Health Data and Analytics, behavioral health expertise, data focus from Dr. Allen and I, and then our resources through CORE specifically. And so what naturally arose from that is, oh, and I should also, of course, mention the governor's office had their presence in this throughout, the clear oversight on my end. And so big things that came from that, the governor's office was focused on increasing enrollment for Black Kentuckians into Medicaid that were not leveraging that. So that became a clear priority. Medicaid, the target was, oh my gosh, how can we hold our managed care organizations more accountable for them analyzing their data, the services that they give, the outreach that they're responsible for within the data space. We can link more systems together. We can ask more questions of that data when we link it. And then Office of Drug Control Policy, let's get corrections at the table. Let's get corrections data at the table, courts data at the table. And so that really reflected the things. And then the CORE funding, we have resources to put out there to communities. How do we do that in an intentional way that really turns on its head the way funding has historically trickled from federal government to state government to local entities?
I just also wanted to note that at the same time that we were developing this application, we learned about the murders of Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd. And our country, of course, dove head first into this incredible social movement highlighting racism at, you know, structural and institutional levels. And so it further spurred our need to ensure that throughout the work that we're doing and through the partners that we support, every single Kentuckian has access to treatment and recovery services, and especially those that are experiencing discrimination at that intersection of racism and having a substance use disorder. And again, thankfully, participating in that collaborative really helped to push this work forward.
That is a great point. I imagine working in this field and being on the ground and doing the work that you're doing during what was a tumultuous, and still is to some extent, a tumultuous time in race relations in this country, while you're so aware of equity and so aware of disparity, had to have a really interesting impact on the way you approach the work that you did. And I wasn't there, but I can only imagine. Do you want to speak to that at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think it for me, it really captured this experience of being, recognizing the multiple roles in one's life, a role where you are in a position of leadership and you have the opportunity to influence power that is often out of reach from people. And how do you hold that responsibility and recognize how you pass that power along to people while you're also a citizen in the community? And I am a resident of Louisville and watching that unfold in person, and then recognizing my cisgendered white status in this country and this society, and grappling with that history and that responsibility that comes with it. And so all of these intersecting pieces at the same time, and then the overdose crisis just, you know, keeping you up every night thinking about what we could be doing more. The burden is deep, and it should be, but the opportunity is equally deep and exciting.
I love the way you phrased that at the end. That was perfect. I love the way you phrased that. My next question is, and you both spoke to this already a little bit, but how do disparate organization and policymakers develop and execute a coordinated statewide vision for SUD continuum of care so that priorities and resources can come together? You've already mentioned making sure that different groups, different people, and different voices have a seat at the table, but how do you bring that forward? How did the two of you, in your own experience with the work that you did, how have you done that or tried to do it?
It's such a great question, Janet, and there's so much to it, right? Like disparate organizations, power differentials. We could unpack vast arrays of consequences of power differentials for days, right? Structural silos, the possibility of perceived or competing incentives within these structures. How do these groups come together to develop a coordinated vision and execute that vision? So just to capture, that's all that was the question. That was a huge question. And so I think I'll start from a place of humility, right? Humility in this process to what I think I know and what I don't know and what we learned and what we thought we learned. And so, again, I'll proceed with conviction to the work in this answer, but also acknowledge my humility. Based on our experience, we first needed to understand the problem and help other people understand the problem. And who we is in this context specifically was largely to begin with state government and our own team. And so we had to, as I've alluded to earlier, look at our local data and not just the national data. And state government is uniquely positioned to do this, to access that data, to link disparate data sets, and to really provide the most comprehensive, likely picture of inequity, of system capacity, of resources than maybe any other entity. And so in doing that, we have to become students of the data. We have to listen to it. We have to respect its nuance and complexity and shortcomings and the structural issues that keep the data from telling us the story that we might have thought it could tell us. And we then have to make that data available to others. I heard a quote recently, and I wish I could attribute it specifically, but I can't. But I'll at least say I did not come up with this on my own. Data is visibility, and visibility is priority. And that is the essence of what we're talking about here. When we look at the data and we put it in forms that people can see it, and we show inequities, we show the structural racism playing out in people's lives, in their health outcomes, and whether literally they're dead or alive, that is how we create the priority. And at the state government level, we can share this bird's eye view that others can't. So that was one, but quantitative data is not sufficient. We need qualitative data. We have to listen to those that are directly impacted. We have to make space and opportunity for dialogue, for presence in these conversations. And I want to turn it over to Dr. Allen to say so much more, but I'll say just as a nod to one other factor, that's that we have to recognize the alignment of all of the distinct and intersecting movements in this work, and recognize how they are. It is essential that we align them, that we align our equity and anti-racism work, our housing, our healthcare access, our drug policy, our environmental work into one common set of priorities and goals. And that's what's going to really help us get to solutions. So
that's such a perfect way to say that, Dr. Marks. And, you know, I think a really good example of these compounding and intersecting issues that require that intersection of our different systems is the COVID-19 pandemic, for example. That, of course, revealed some deep-seated inequities in our healthcare system, particularly within communities of color. We know that early on in the pandemic, people of color, particularly Black people, were contracting COVID at higher rates, and they were more likely to die of COVID over any other racial group. There was actually a National Institutes of Health-funded study that found that people with substance use disorders are more susceptible to COVID and also its complications. And that was especially true among Black persons with a substance use disorder. So in the sample, which I believe was well over 7.5 million people, Black patients were over two times more likely to contract COVID, especially if they had an opioid use disorder. Black patients with a substance use disorder were more likely to be hospitalized. They were also more likely to die of COVID as well. And there's, of course, a number of social and economic factors that contributed to those disparities, as well as disparities in overdose deaths, in treatment access and treatment retention and treatment outcomes. And this example speaks to the importance of considering how those multiple systems and institutions and movements all intersect with one another to impact individual lives. So when we're building out our programs, when we're building out policy, we really have to take all of those varying components into consideration in order to ensure coordinated response and well-coordinated effort.
Well said. I think this also leads into my next question too. So there's an oft-repeated quote, and it's attributed to Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, that conveys that states are the laboratories of democracy. And at its core, I think the statement was meant to convey that states should serve as a laboratory for novel social and economic experiments that might be too unwieldy or too novel for traditional federal government. What are some of the state-level programs and initiatives that increase access to opioid prevention and education that you can see working on a national level because of the success on a state level, and in particular here, because of your work here in Kentucky?
Well, one of the most exciting and one of the most personally meaningful outcomes of our project with NGA is an initiative that we developed that leveraged our state opioid response funds to expand service access in communities of color and break down stigma to accessing treatment within those communities. But we wanted to do that with providers and with community organizations that not only provided services within those communities, but entities that embodied health equity as an organization, and also those that were reflective of the community in which they intended to serve. So we had really great opportunity to partner with a nonprofit organization out of Louisville, and they're really champions of community wellness. We were able to engage their network of partners to disseminate a funding opportunity. We funded 10 organizations to develop and implement outreach activities that would increase community understanding and reduce stigma and provide information about how services can be accessed. And this program was just so incredibly special. The activities have come to fruition, and they're just things that we never could have thought about, and we never would have put together ourselves. The services are tailored for those communities by those communities, and the grantees have worked very collaboratively to establish a sustainable engagement strategy within communities of color. They've implemented tailored outreach activities and events, initiatives that focus on awareness and prevention and harm reduction and recovery, and not only among BIPOC adults and BIPOC youth, but also Latinx, also LGBTQ plus communities. And also some of these partners came together to execute this very focused media campaign. It's called Recover Boldly. And this campaign placed billboards throughout the city and on the side of city buses that service BIPOC communities. And it depicted strength and resilience and highlighted a need for coming together and recovering together as a community in order to break the stigma, increase acceptance, increase engagement, dismantle disparities. Initiatives like these are just so incredibly critical. Dr. Marks, I know you feel just as passionate as I do about this project. Please feel free to weigh in. But we were just so proud of this work, and it was a direct result of our work with NGA. And we look forward to continuing this as well in the coming years.
I want Dr. Marks to jump in, but I just want to say you sound so enthusiastic and so excited about it. Dr. Marks, what did you want to add?
I was first going to reflect on that. You can't see our beaming faces through this podcast, but we're looking at each other and just the expressions and the aggressive nodding throughout this of excitement and support for each other is just there. So know that that's happening. I think there are some other things about the NGA Inspire project that were really important and new for us. One was to partner with an entity in the state that had the ability to disseminate funding and reduce some of the challenges of partnering with state government. So what happens when the state releases a notice of funding opportunity is there's a complex application process. There are a lot of requirements for the organizations, and there are reasons why certain organizations and groups of people are less equipped and have been less underempowered to respond to those calls for funding. And so we can see over time the same types of organizations building up their funding and other organizations falling to the wayside. And so by placing these funds into a partner in the community that had the ability to support the financial processes of these institutions, to be independent in its review, to be reflective of the community that they wanted to serve, it really broke down some of these traditional barriers to getting federal funds down to the right community partners. And so that was really exciting to see the process work effectively. We learned this based on a model from California. So if anyone from California is listening, know we're giving a huge shout out to the gratitude of the work that's been done out there. And then we're seeing the benefits on the other side of this. Some of those organizations that this was the very first time they've ever received state funding are now applying directly to the state and receiving that funding. They know that these opportunities exist. They know how to apply. And so it's really doing exactly what we hoped. It's supporting people in the community to access resources, but it's also building up that provider capacity.
Oh, I love that. So breaking down traditional barriers. Do you remember the name of the organization that you worked with in Louisville?
Yeah, so in Louisville, they're called Inspire, and they're the nonprofit arm of Park Community Credit Union.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. So what role, you spoke about what are some of the ways we can break down barriers, but what role do state governments play in developing and encouraging strategies to expand the public health and safety and prioritizing linking individuals to treatment? How do we get state government to be more involved? Not everyone has a Dr. Allen and a Dr. Marks working in their state government entities. What are some things that we can do to help?
Well, there's certainly a lot of things on that list. States, you know, we play a key role in building an infrastructure and in systems that support access and availability and also linkage to treatment. And that goes from building up a data infrastructure that adequately captures who is being served and where are the gaps in services, whether services are quality, whether they're effective, and that also trails into building up a recovery-oriented system of care that takes into account all of the many facets of a person that can support their recovery. So that ranges from national and state policy and drills all the way down to services they receive, social determinants like employment and housing, individual culture, family, and religion. Obviously, building a system that intersects all of those components is quite complex, but it's necessary in order to treat the whole person. And we continue to work with our partners and within our own agency and partner state agencies to build out that recovery-oriented system. Another key infrastructure component is ensuring that we fund equitable and quality services. And our standard funding sources are our state funds, our block grant funds, our state opioid response funds, Medicaid funds. You know, we have to ensure that those funded services are quality, that they're evidence-based, evidence-informed, promising practices, you know, looking at what the data is telling us and what our communities are telling us as well. And as Dr. Mark mentioned, with our work with Inspire, we, of course, had to be innovative and think creatively to overcome barriers in terms of funding and building enough infrastructure that would not limit those entities that we don't typically work with that are serving those communities that we're having trouble engaging. We also can leverage our contract processes. I touched on this briefly earlier, but one of the key outcomes of our work with NGA was incorporating language into our contracts with our partners that we're funding that ensured that they were meeting community need, that they were disaggregating their data by race and other demographic outcomes, and also making data-informed decisions in how to improve access and fill gaps in services for people of color and also other underrepresented and under-resourced communities. And lastly, I'll also note that the state plays a key role in building our behavioral health workforce. The pandemic has led to some unprecedented workforce shortages, which I'm sure, Chan, you may well be aware of. And that impacts our ability to provide and expand services. Mm-hmm. So we have to explore and develop innovative strategies to continue to meet our community needs. And that's especially true for building a culturally responsive workforce that can address the unique needs of every person that walks through their doors. So we have to increase investments in recruiting and retaining our behavioral health providers, especially providers that are Black, Indigenous, people of color. We also have to facilitate ongoing learning opportunities for our partners to expand their understanding of equity, disparity, and other important issues that are directly impacting their communities. We also have to expand training within our own organization in order to be able to adequately support our partners. And our department, our cabinet really has done an incredible job in building equity and infusing equity into everything that we do. And so we've certainly conducted anti-racism trainings and other basic level trainings for our own staff, but those one-off trainings are not sufficient, and we have to be consistent and we have to provide ongoing education so that we can continue to consider equity again in all that we do, in our funding decisions and our policy decisions, and also support implementation of programs out in our communities that are taking those same things into consideration.
Thank you. Great point. Dr. Marks, did you want to add anything? Or
I just love following Dr. Allen in these comments. This was wonderful. I'll throw a few things out there. Obviously, states have a role in policy, and I think we just need to remember both policy barriers and policy facilitators. We have, as state leadership, the ability to create policies that facilitate health outcomes, that facilitate the ability of entities to communicate with each other, to share information. And so we need to address barriers, but also really look at what we can facilitate. Reimbursement structure, what we pay for is what we get, right? And it's sometimes almost as simple as that. And so we have a responsibility as we build the system of care to pay attention to what we're in fact reimbursing and decide if that is or is not aligned with our values. And then very concretely, I think building that infrastructure that kind of only the state level can do in communication, in helping people to understand how they access services, how providers talk to each other in terms of referral. So those are some concrete things, but I wanted to make sure that we talk about two things as well. State government absolutely has a responsibility to address the failed war on drugs. And I think that we've made some strides in leadership acknowledging that the drug war has failed. We now hear that relatively often, but what we really need to do is name more specifically what we mean by the drug war and what exactly failed with that drug war. I think it's staying too superficial as a comment. And so we need to understand and talk about what failed and also what and who succeeded from the drug war. And so obviously at a high level, the drug war failed. We shouldn't incarcerate individuals rather than provide services. And that is certainly a conclusion of this, but there's so much more. And it's the responsibility of state government to ask those questions and provide answers around criminalization and punishment and systemic racism and addressing substances rather than people and stigmatizing certain people and certain substances. And so I think we just have to continue to press deeper and ask more questions about what it means. And there are thought leaders that have talked about this extensively. I am echoing the ideas of visionaries in our community right now in this work. States also have a responsibility and an opportunity to be working to embedding harm reduction principles and strategies into our policies and systems. You typically hear about prevention, treatment, recovery, but harm reduction really has to underscore that entire process. And there's two pieces of harm reduction that I always like to emphasize, and that is reducing the inherent but also the imposed harms of our system. And so I have to put a plug right here for Maya Solovitz, who wrote thoughtfully about this in a book that was recently published called Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction. She unpacks very concretely and nicely how we can think about both at the state and federal level harm reduction in terms of both reversing or reducing the inherent but also the imposed harms of drugs and substances.
That is a great point. And I'm actually writing down some of the key persons and organizations in the book that you have mentioned and Dr. Allen mentioned, because I'm hoping to put little notes in for the podcast so that if people listening want to find out more, they can. And my final question for both of you is, I just want to preface this with, I'm finally honored to have both of you on the podcast, but we did have to delay at one point because both of you had to go help out in Eastern Kentucky, where there have been historic floods and profound damage from the flooding. And I don't think, I didn't realize, and I don't think many of our listeners realize, how important it is to have people involved in SUD and OUD recovery and treatment and behavioral health doing a disaster. And can you explain a little bit or talk a little bit about the work that you were doing out there?
Absolutely. And I'll preface this by saying the last year, Kentucky has been devastated by natural disasters. In December of last year, there were some very devastating tornadoes that impacted the western part of our state. And then obviously at the end of July, early August, the flooding in eastern Kentucky just completely devastated our citizens that live in that region. And so over the last year, our department has really been expanding into this space of behavioral health disaster response and, you know, what our role is and how we can support our community providers that they themselves are likely impacted by these disasters, but how we can help them to ensure that services continue, how we can help them to ensure that their patients have access to whatever other services they may need, whatever housing, clothing, food. I mean, there's so many different components that go into this. So one of the first things that we did, both for the in response to tornadoes and in response to the flooding, is we applied for a SAMHSA Community Crisis Program grant. And essentially, it allowed for us to work with our community mental health center. So we have 14 community mental health regions throughout our state. And so they serve specific counties. There's 120 in Kentucky. They cover all 120. And so we worked with the community mental health centers in the specific regions that were impacted by these disasters. And they were able to develop teams of community crisis counselors that could go out to where the people were that were impacted. So whether it was shelters, whether it was state parks, whether it was other community spaces, they were able to go in and make sure that folks had, you know, are you okay? What can we immediately do to help make sure that you have what you need? And then if we needed to connect you with behavioral health services, we would do that right away. But obviously not trying to provide treatment right at that moment, but ensuring that they have access to that if needed, but just letting them know that somebody is there. And so both we started that with our response in Western Kentucky and continue that with our response in Eastern Kentucky. And we call that our Project Recovery. And so if anybody's interested, we have a website, and our community mental health centers have done some really incredible work building up that system and building up that program. We've also applied to receive a disaster case management grant. And again, this isn't specific to behavioral health, but again, it's around helping these folks get access and navigate all these different complex systems between applying for assistance through FEMA and getting housing and getting supports for themselves as they start to recover from these disasters. And so that is another grant and another program that we're building up at this point, but obviously very excited about the potential to just make sure, again, that people know there's somebody there. They know that there's someone that they can go to. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of mental health and substance use issues that arise during times of disaster. And we just want to make sure that people have connection and know that there are resources available when they need them.
Thank you. Dr. Mox, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I'll add the responsibility of the Department for Behavioral Health is to provide and support the behavioral health safety net for Kentucky. And so that really came into play in this moment. And one of the things that was exciting to see is this evolution of the recognition of the central concern of increased risk for overdose and return to use during this time of trauma and stress. And so what we saw is that as communities and as community leaders reached out to the state and said, this is what we need. We need food. We need shelter. We need clean water. They said, we need naloxone. We need fentanyl test strips. It was such a high priority for these communities because they now understand how intrinsically related these experiences are and the social determinants of health, recovery capital, how those all are so important in times of disaster. And so the ability to provide those resources, to leverage networks through quick response teams and recovery community centers and hub situation tables that could just, they didn't even pivot. They just did more of the same, which was kind of beautiful to see, to serve these communities and to put out the message that, you know, these stressors are going to make it harder to remain in recovery and remission. And drug supply is going to change. That's a natural consequence of this. How do we continue to support people and not inadvertently punish them during this time of heightened need?
Thank you so much for sharing that. That's all the time we have for today. I want to thank both Dr. Allen and Dr. Marks for speaking with me today. If you would like to reach out to either of them with questions or comments or speaking engagement inquiries, we will provide their respective emails in the podcast description and notes. Thank you again, Dr. Allen and Dr. Marks, and thank you, listeners. Please join us for the next One-on-One with LAPA, where we will discuss another interesting topic. Have a great day.